This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Mantanas hosting tonight with Ruby Susan. Member of anti-Islam group Reclaim Australia, Philip Galea, was arrested yesterday for anti-terrorism raids in Melbourne. Philip was also jailed last year, just days before an anti-mosque rally. Police have also not ruled out further charges. Tonight, Kieran Bennett, a spokesperson for Campaign Against Fascism and Racism in Australia, joins us along with Assistant Commissioner and Head of Counterterrorism Command Ross Gunther and Senior Lecturer in the School of Social and Political Science at the University of Melbourne, Dr. Lauren Rosemoore, to discuss what constitutes a terrorism attack in Victoria and yesterday's arrest of Philip Galea.
You're listening to The Informer on Joy 94.9. I'm Ruby Susan and I'm joined by Ross Gunther, the Assistant Commissioner and Head of Counterterrorism Command. Thank you so much for joining us, Ross.
Thanks very much, Ruby.
There has been a lot of activity over this weekend in regards to the arrest of Philip Galea, his second time being arrested in response to terrorist allegations. Now, this has led confusion across our community as to what constitutes a terrorist threat. When does the counterterrorism unit get involved in an investigation?
Yeah, sure. Look, it is a really good question and sometimes people do get confused. So we operate under the Commonwealth Criminal Code, which talks about a terrorist act being a threat or with an intention to advance a political, ideological or religious cause by coercing or intimidating an Australian or foreign government or the public, by causing serious harm, creating a serious risk of health or disrupting trade, critical infrastructure, etc. So predominantly it's about an act or a threat that's likely to cause harm within the Victorian community.
And that's been motivated by an ideology.
Yeah, political, yeah. Ideological or religious.
Religious, yeah.
Yeah.
So obviously then religion doesn't have to be involved. Do you think that this word is being used exclusively for Islamic extremists? Do you think that's an accurate suggestion?
Yeah, look, I think there's no doubt that our focus in recent years has been around Islamic extremism, but I've always liked to take the opportunity to emphasise the fact that we really look at the criminality. It's the danger of causing harm within their community, and whether that comes from someone that was of an extreme view that Islamist, or whether that comes from someone that's right-wing or left-wing or religious or not religious, we really look at the potential for harm in our community.
So no one group has ownership of terrorism as a label?
No, you're absolutely right. It's really important we get the message here that our role is trying to preserve social cohesion in our state. One thing we do have, and I've commented on it frequently, is that Victoria is a great place of multicultural stature. It has been for a long time. So part of our role in doing this is to preserve that.
Now, there was a statement earlier on Saturday that the information that led to this arrest was handed in earlier in the year. Is there a general time frame for a terrorist investigation? Does it usually take a few months or even longer? I know this is just the beginning of an ongoing investigation.
We do have investigations that are held over very short periods of time where risk is substantial, and so we would go to resolution quite quickly. Mm-hmm. And we do have those, such as these, that go over many months.
Now, Philip Galea has been arrested last year for possessing unlicensed tasers and the ingredients and instructions to create explosives a few days before an anti-mosque rally. Will this be taken into consideration?
Look, I can't come upon matters before the court.
I also noticed that in your comments you have mentioned that there may be other people brought in for questioning as the investigation continues. So far you could say it is not settled that there's only one person who's under investigation?
Yes, that's true. One thing we do know, these investigations, they tend to branch off after an initial phase of resolution, so there could be other people that we need to speak to in the near or medium term.
I do understand there's only so much information you can provide before a court case. Back to a bit more of a general question. What does it take for an organisation to be classified as a terrorist organisation?
The classifications for those that are prohibited organisations, is that what you're talking about?
If an organisation moves, if there's continuous action, can that organisation be reclassified as a terrorist organisation?
Yeah, there are those groups which are regarded as classified terrorist organisations in this country.
Yep.
And the responsible entity for making those declarations of the Attorney General's office, obviously through the Commonwealth.
What kind of circumstances would create that change?
Well, the criteria I would imagine that would be used, the benchmark would be that those organisations are promoting death, serious harm or conduct that would endanger a person or persons. Mm-hmm. It could relate to serious damage to property. It could be relate to serious risk to the health or safety more broadly of the public, or anything that interferes with their critical infrastructure, aviation or something like that.
I imagine there would have to be pretty convincing evidence that it is the organisation as a whole and not select individuals. Is that correct?
Yeah, those that are listed would be subject to very, very strict criteria in that assessment, I'm sure.
Galea is associated with Reclaim Australia, as you mentioned in previous statements, as well as a number of other organisations. Now, a few of these organisations have received backing from quite prominent politicians. Do you believe that during investigations such as these, politicians need to step back, perhaps?
I'm not aware specifically of any recent occasions where politicians have been involved in supporting the rallies or different groups, but my view really sits around where our role is as counterterrorism command in restricting people from inflicting harm on our community. So I'm sure if our politicians thought that that was a likely event and those people that they associated with, they'd be quite mindful of that.
I just have one final question. On the Reclaim Australia website, it does say government is founded exclusively on law and that government itself then becomes a religion to implement or execute or enforce divine revelation. And they say that governments that abuse the authority set by God by going against God's law are nothing more than a cult surrounding false religion that creates unjust law. Now, this kind of a statement is suggesting, of course, that our law system is cultish. Do you believe that the kind of attitude of then trying to separate yourself from the law of the land is a dangerous one?
Yeah, look, I mean, I guess we live in a democratic society, so there are various groups that promulgate their own observations on how our society is structured or how the law is implemented. But from my own point of view, I can just reiterate the fact that we purely look at a risk to the community. Yeah. I take very strongly the responsibility I have in doing whatever I can as leading the command, and particularly with our involvement with the joint counter-terrorism team with the Australian Federal Police.
Yep.
In preventing harm to the community. So sometimes I'm sure that won't be in accord with some of the groups that have different views.
Philip Galea will be appearing in court tomorrow. That was Assistant Commissioner and Head of Counterterrorism Command, Ross Gunther. Thank you so much for joining us, Ross, and helping us to understand a bit more about the role of counterterrorism in Victoria.
Thanks, Ruby, and thanks for the opportunity to talk.
You're listening to The Informer, Joy's news and current affairs program. We're now joined by political scientist Dr. Lauren Rosewarm. Thanks for joining us tonight, Lauren.
Good evening.
It's great to have you here on the show. Now, you spoke yesterday on the ABC about the links between masculinity and conservatism and the violent outcomes. So I suppose we can start right there. Now, what do you think the draw is to conservatism? Like, what is the draw of conservatism to men?
Look, I think particularly now, although this has been something that's not that can be dated back into the 1980s, is that with some of the successes that come with feminism, it means that power needs to be redistributed, which means the people who have power have to give up some power. And in a context of gender, that generally means men are going to have to give up some power, some leadership roles to women. There are some men who find this incredibly threatening, and that then leads to a backlash where you have a re-embrace of things such as conservative politics, where roles of women are, or there's an attempt to restrict the roles of women so that there is not that threat to male power and threat to the status quo.
Do you think race has also played a factor in this, as we have moved towards a more equal society and attempting to bring races up to equality as well? Do you think that is also a factor for some white men?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Any kind of redistribution of power, and we've seen it with LGBTI issues as well as race and religion, is that when there's a rise in power of groups that have been traditionally marginalised, those with the power, i.e. white heterosexual men, will have to give up some of that power. It's no surprise that those men are the men who populate groups such as Reclaim Australia, who are feeling that their supremacy is being threatened.
Now, did the arrest this weekend surprise you at all?
No. Unquestionably, because any time that, like, for example, the issues of migration is a hugely hot-button topic in Australia and around the world. So these groups, these kind of vaguely neo-Nazi groups, are rising up around the world, not just in Australia, and therefore it's no surprise that these groups are going to be involved in efforts to be more militant with their politics.
Do you think this combination of hard-right conservatism and masculinity is one that will result in violence on an increasing basis or on a continuous basis?
It's very much dependent on how these groups are policed and monitored. For example, as greater freedoms, liberties, concessions are given to minority groups, these neo-Nazi groups have greater reason to fear change, and therefore with that comes either an acceptance or greater and heightened hostility. So I think that it is likely that as we go forward, you're going to see, and as has happened around the world, anger and disappointment with policy is enacted in acts of violence, yes.
Do you think that when classifying what is in a role of terrorism, why do you think we are less likely to call groups such as Reclaim Australia, which, you know, have on their front page that all law is biblical and thus represents a comfort between man and God, why do you think we're less likely to call those groups radical Christian groups as opposed to radical Islam?
One explanation is that Christianity is considered to be a default in a country like Australia. So that's the norm. And therefore, because it's a norm, it's only religious groups and groups with religious affiliations that are not Christian that we're ready to classify as political extremists. But because Christianity is assumed as the default, it's considered to be normal and therefore not deviant or not problematic.
I find that quite interesting. As one on Reclaim Australia's opening page of their website, they do say that when government abuses the authority delegated by God through God's law, then it becomes a false religious cult, which makes all Western government nothing more than a cult surrounding the false religion it created with its own unjust law, because this law has become a vain substitute and an affront to God's law found in the Bible. Now, there is a lot of repetition of law against this idea of these rules that we must have. Why is it we're seeing people move back towards hardline rules?
Well, this is exactly the same as why you have the rise of fundamentalism in terms of Islam in certain countries. There is an effort to go back to doctrine, an effort to go back to certain sacred texts as though they have all the answers, because there is a perception that in modernity, in modern culture, we've become very postmodern and willing to question all that we know. Of course we're doing this. And therefore these groups are quite reluctant to have this done, and therefore they like to believe that all the answers are written in a series of texts, and therefore we have to look to those texts as opposed to moving forward. Remember, all of these groups are conservative groups at heart. They don't want change. They don't want redistribution of power.
Do you think that there's also, of course, the Bible as well as the Quran also do have a lot of strict rules that do govern women? Do you believe that there is that they're more likely to want to enforce those rules than the rules that would be enforced upon themselves?
Oh, absolutely. I think what we need to remember as well is that the Bible, the Quran, the Torah, etc., are all open to interpretation. So when we talk about fundamentalism and we talk about a strict doctrine reading of these scriptures, in fact, that's still interpretation. These documents were very rarely written in English, and therefore, it's, over time, they've been interpreted as to how it advantages a certain group. So I think this idea of single truth is a misnomer anyway, and it's also very common for these rules to be used as an ad hoc or cherry-picked basis, where we pick the doctrine that we like and ignore the other stuff that is contained in these documents.
So finally, do you think that given this weekend's events, groups like the United Patriot Front do pose a consistent threat to our community?
But yes, they need to be monitored. And I think, they need to be monitored just as readily as we're monitoring other groups that are much more well-established as problems, such as, you know, radical Islam. I think we need to also be aware that, in fact, homegrown terrorists who look white and who are Christian can also pose a problem, just as they have a very long history in the United States, for example, of terrorist acts through bombing abortion clinics. This is not a new problem.
With that in mind, do you think that the word terrorist is being overused, or do you think that groups like these, we need to redefine and start using terrorist to describe non-Islamic groups?
Look, all terrorism really means is, you know, an attempt to create an environment of terror in a society. And I think, you know, we think of another way to phrase that, if you like, is political extremism, provided that there's some sort of objective that's connected in some way to power or faith, then the terms are usefully applicable. I think, however, we've become very quick to use the term terrorism whenever there's any faith-based or assumed faith-based connection, as opposed to looking at what other common denominators are in these cases, i.e. men. These are invariably, almost exclusively men perpetrating these crimes with mental health problems. Why then is terrorism more of a factor than masculinity or mental health?
Continuing on that thought, would it surprise you to know that out of the 20 organisations that are listed as terrorist organisations by our country, 19 of them are Islamic?
No, it wouldn't surprise me because, again, we're in a zeitgeist at the moment where we have a heightened sensitivity around Islamic organisations, regardless of whether there's a basis for that or not.
Now, what role do you think the media needs to play in combating radicalisation in hard-right conservatism, including and especially in Christian white groups?
I'm a bit conflicted with this question because on one hand I think our culture disproportionately focuses on these attention in these stories in the media. For example, whenever there's any terrorist story, you're going to have round-the-clock coverage of it in a kind of what I think a sort of pornographic way where every angle is milked ad nauseum. I think a danger of that kind of coverage is giving incentive to other groups that there's a payoff from committing acts of terrorism because it, A, makes a population stop and think, but also live in a state of fear, which is exactly what terrorists want. So I think the media has it's a complicated relationship they need to report. I think that the gratuitous reporting is dangerous. So I'm not sure whether media is actually the solution here.
Do you think we need to be a little more careful before labelling attacks terrorist?
I think we need to have grounds for terrorists that enact as terrorism, and that this is tricky because you've got at the moment a very willingness, if you have a copy of the Quran at your house, for example,
yeah,
and are involved in some sort of act of violence, we're very ready to dub you as a terrorist. Now, can we make that link so readily? It's interesting because we want to understand it as terrorism because then there's also a concerted effort by government to want to act to consider these events terrorism because, again, it's a justification for increased resources and also different laws apply in terms of investigation. So there's a push to have events like this framed as terrorism because, again, it gets the power of government behind it. I'm not sure whether it's useful as a label. Certainly, I would like to see more analysis and more discussion about the gendered aspects of this because there's, you know, research already shows that there's a link between terrorists and particularly recent acts of terrorism in Nice and in Orlando where you've got men who are involved who've also been perpetrators of domestic violence. So why are they more terrorists than wife beaters, for example?
That is a really good point, especially, and I suppose while Philip Galea has not been charged with domestic violence, this is his second charge for a terrorist-related plan. So hopefully this is, hopefully we'll start to see at least if the word is used less often and we're more inclined to use it for acts of terror that do include our white Christian population. Thank you so
much. Absolutely.
Sorry. Thank you so much for joining us, Lauren. We really appreciate it.
Anytime. Thank you for having me.
You're listening to The Informer on Joy. That was Dr. Lauren Rosewarne, a political scientist from Melbourne University. We are now joined by Kieran, a spokesperson from the Campaign Against Racism and Fascism. Thanks for joining us, Kieran.
Happy to be here.
Now, moving on to, based on what Lauren was saying about the male aspects of desire and control as we move away from, you know, our male-dominated society, Philip Galea was a member of several organisations that the Campaign Against Racism and Fascism has had altercations with. Now, in your experience with these altercations, would you say that it is a predominantly masculine aggression that you're facing?
It's an interesting composition. Phil Galea is associated with, at various times, Reclaim Australia, the United Patriots Front, and an outfit called the True Blue Crew. And all of these are definitely led by men. All of them are predominantly composed of men, but also all their rhetoric is very much around the fact that they're powerful men. So you see the likes of Sherman Burgess from Reclaim Australia and later the UPF would often appear posing with gym equipment in videos in which he would explain how strong he was and how strong their ideology was. You see the same thing with the current leader of the UPF, Blair Cottrell, makes the link very explicitly that he's an exceptionally muscular man, and that makes his political point of view more valid. And when you look at something like the True Blue Crew, well, they're quite explicitly a male street fighting gang.
So what would you define him as, a racist or a fascist?
Fascist.
I think it's appropriate when describing people like Phil Galea and these movements, like they are definitely racist, but I think it's appropriate to use the word fascist. And I use that in a very specific political sense, in that these people have a racist nationalist ideology that they're attempting to impose in public and in the political space through the use of a street movement, through political force, but also through the threat of violence on the streets. They're right-wing, they're outside the established conservative political order, and they're attempting to impose their political ideology with a threat of radical force.
You mentioned that they're outside the political order, but Reclaim Australia especially has had political support from now Senator Pauline Hanson as well as MP George Christensen, to name two. Do you think that helps legitimise their views?
Absolutely. And when I say that they're outside mainstream, they're not part of the Liberal Party as such, but there's definitely a continuum between, say, the politics that we see espoused from the right wing of the Liberal Party in Parliament, all the way through to the likes of Reclaim Australia, the True Blue Crew and the UPF. There's sort of a mutual feeding on process that occurs. When we look at the likes of Pauline Hanson, there's certainly the sense that, say, George Christensen addressing a Reclaim Australia rally gives them some legitimacy, or Pauline Hanson appearing at multiple rallies or appearing with neo-Nazis appears to convey legitimacy. But the same thing in reverse has also happened. I think very much that, you know, we saw Pauline Hanson do very well at the most recent election, and she did very well despite, for years and years, she's contested elections and not done well at all. She's not polled 5% in a long time. But what happened in the past year was that groups like Reclaim Australia opened the political space, expanded the definition of what the political mainstream was, and Pauline Hanson, in comparison, is now apparently more part of that racist political mainstream.
Did the arrest this weekend surprise you?
I'm sorry?
Did Philip Galea's arrest this weekend come as a surprise to you?
Well, it's the third time that Phil Galea's been arrested. I had a bit of a chuckle. Phil Galea's been done on weapons charges. He's been done for bringing a flare to a public protest and for possessing a surprisingly large quantity of mercury, which I'm sure that he never intended to do anything illegal at all with that mercury. It's only alleged that bomb making manual. So I'm not surprised at all that he's at it now that he's at large. Well, he was at large. he served a month for the weapons and the mercury, which was a shockingly... it's interesting, because if Phil Galea had been a Muslim, I'd always thought that he'd spend a much longer period of time in prison a lot faster.
Since he has been arrested for similar charges, do you believe that he acts alone, or are his actions a reflection on the groups he participates in?
Phil Galea does not act alone. Phil Galea is part of a far-right network. They're not all necessarily structured membership organisations, as you might understand it, but there's definitely a milieu that they have contacts, converse with, discuss online, construct plans about what they're going to do politically and then go and implement them. Phil Galea is often, you know, seen at public protests with it, includes Neil Harris.
Sorry, the line's getting a little fuzzy there. Could you repeat that last bit for us?
He acts as part of the network. We've seen him at political actions called by other known fascists and neo-Nazis in Melbourne. Yeah. And it was interesting, Neil Erickson, a well-known neo-Nazi, when Galea was arrested over the weekend, immediately posted a video on his Facebook page saying his mate Phil Galea had been arrested, that it was a frame-up, and that he was going to prank the police by sending some messages to Phil Galea's phone. Phil Galea does not act alone.
No, the police have not, of course, ruled out bringing in other suspects for questioning at this current time. Of course, they are quite closed off until the court case opens tomorrow. Now, do you believe that groups like the United Patriot Front and True Blue are as great a threat to our community as Islamic extremism?
I think that they're perhaps more of a threat to our community in that what they represent is more of a capacity to create a certain type of change in the political space in Australia. These far-right groups want to impose their ideas around what is acceptable and what is not acceptable in public in Australia. They want to, you know, they want to reclaim white Australia, basically. I think that's Islamic extremism, so-called, in Australia is utterly marginal and has long been utterly marginal, and no one takes it terribly seriously as a political force. It's never going to mobilise, you know, large segments of the Muslim community, let alone the wider Australian community. But something like Reclaim Australia, if not forcefully opposed and if their politics are not rejected, has much more possibility of building a quite frightening movement.
My final question. Now, the Commonwealth has listed 20 organisations as officially terrorist organisations. 19 of those are Islamic, with one exception being the Kurdistan Workers' Party. Now, do you believe that with 19 of our terrorist listed organisations being Islamic, there is a lean towards applying that label with greater haste?
I think that the public listing of terrorism organisations in Australia is a political exercise that has very little to do with the reality of the threats that might face Australia in terms of security or the wider community. The Attorney General's Department lists, you know, various groups as terrorist organisations based on whatever the political priorities of the government are at a particular time. The fact of the matter is that being involved in a conspiracy to commit acts of violence is illegal, and supporting, you know, conspiracies that do that is illegal, irrespective of whether they're on some list or not. So the composition of Australia's so-called, you know, terrorist list is patently absurd. There are a variety of organisations on that have absolutely no link to Australia, organisations on that effectively don't exist, you know, and I think that points to the political priorities behind its composition rather than it having any important security basis.
Thank you so much for joining us this evening, Kieran. We really appreciate it. Have a great evening.
You too. Thank you very much.
Thank you to today's guests, Kieran Bennett, a spokesperson for Campaign Against Fascism and Racism in Australia, political scientist Dr. Lauren Rosewarne, and Assistant Commissioner and Head of Counterterrorism Command, Ross Gunther. We reached out to the United Patrons Front, but sadly, we got no comment.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast, brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.